You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, September 16th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dave Zirin, sports editor at The Nation magazine and author of many books, including his latest, The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. Meanwhile, booster shots continue to divide experts at the FDA as the Biden administration tries to authorize them starting next week. For Pfizer, the WHO and other international organizations have pleaded with wealthier nations, don't okay booster shots until poorer nations get some. The nation hit a deadly milestone yesterday. Over two-thirds of a million people, over 666,000, have now died due to coronavirus in this country, meaning one in every 500 U.S. residents have died of COVID-19. Conservative House Democrats on the Energy and Commerce Committee have sunk a proposal, at least temporarily, that allows Medicare to negotiate lower drug prices, saving the government money. And one of those Democrats, Kathleen Rice, has a spot on this committee after leadership kind of tilted the scales to keep one Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of that slot. This is a part of the larger fight over infrastructure, where conservative Democrats are also apparently growing restless and angry at Pelosi, who promised them a vote on the bipartisan bill on the 27th, but Manchin and Sinema bogging down reconciliation in the Senate. Yesterday, four U.S. gymnasts testified on the FBI's mishandling of the investigation into Larry Nassar in deeply moving testimony about their abuse and government inaction. More on that in a bit. And lastly, Biden, as a part of his pivot to China, has announced that the U.S. will help Australia deploy nuclear-powered submarines, giving the U.S. a military presence in that region, or at least by proxy, and, of course, escalating a conflict for the sake of it. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. We have a great show for you today. Obviously, I'm very excited to talk to Dave. We pre-recorded the interview before this broadcast today, and you'll get to see that. I loved our conversation. He is very busy. That's why we had to pre-record it, because his book is taking the world by storm. But I'm thankful that he took time out of his busy schedule to speak with us about this, because, as you know, I'm passionate about politics and sports and one reflecting the other. And I think we have a really great conversation about it. Now, this is a bit of a darker topic, but also involving sports. Yesterday, four American gymnasts testified in front of Congress, including Michaela Maroney, Simone Biles. My understanding is she's considered one of the greatest gymnasts of all time by many people, about the FBI's failure to act adequately on serial sexual abuser and pedophile Larry Nassar, who was the U.S. gymnastics team's team doctor for 18 years, where he used his power to abuse countless girls. I think the advocates say he abused over 120 now women, but I think one of the victims was 6 years old, and I think that wasn't an anomaly. I think a lot of these girls were quite young, and many of these women, now women, are high profile because they are part of the gymnastics teams. They've won gold medals. And they use their power to talk about the FBI's complete dereliction of duty, although I would argue it's part of a larger FBI pattern, in this testimony. Now, Nassar was sentenced to 60 years in 2017 after another time where the emotional burden was put on these women to testify publicly about the abuse. He is going to spend the rest of his life in jail, and he's going to die there. That there's no question about it. But this brings up larger questions about the FBI. Here is Michaela Maroney going in and ripping into the FBI, totally understandably, about their reaction to the statement that she provided for them.
Yeah, just to clarify, she came to the FBI in 2015.
Yes, yes. And he was sentenced in 2017. So she, I think, was 19 at the time. She hadn't even told her mother about the abuse. And she said she spoke to the FBI. She talks about telling them this incredibly traumatizing experience, telling them about that on the floor of her bedroom. And here she is ripping into the FBI for how they reacted to her statement.
Be molested by Larry Nassar. According to the OIG report, about 14 months after I disclosed my abuse to the FBI, nearly a year and a half later, the FBI agent who interviewed me in 2015 decided to write down my statement, a statement that the OIG report determined to be materially false. Let's be honest. By not taking immediate action from my report, they allowed a child molester to go free for more than a year. And this inaction directly allowed Nassar's abuse to continue. What is the point of reporting abuse if our own FBI agents are going to take it upon themselves to bury that report in a drawer? They had legal, legitimate evidence of child abuse and did nothing. If they're not going to protect me, I want to know, who are they trying to protect? What's even more upsetting to me is that we know that these FBI agents have committed an obvious crime. They falsified my statement, and that is illegal in itself. Yet no recourse has been taken against them. The Department of Justice refused to prosecute these individuals. Why? Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco couldn't even bring herself to be here today, and it is the Department of Justice's job to hold them accountable. I am tired of waiting for people to do the right thing, because my abuse was enough and we deserve justice. These individuals clearly violated policies and were negligent in executing their duties. And in doing so, more girls were abused by Larry Nassar for over a year. To not indict these agents is a disservice to me and my teammates. It is a disservice to the system, which was built to protect all of us from abuse. It was a disservice to every victim who suffered needlessly at the hands of Larry Nassar after I spoke up. Why are public servants whose job is to protect getting away with this? This is not justice. Enough is enough. Today, I ask you all to hear my voice. I ask you, please.
Well, that was incredibly powerful, and part of the issue is that the FBI is not here to protect us. The FBI is here to serve U.S. hegemonic interests.
Yeah, the New York Times reported on this yesterday, and they characterized this as a remarkable turn where Christopher Wray acknowledged the agency's mishandling, but all he does is say he's sick that that happened. He's very apologized. I'm sorry that so many people let you down again and again. So many people, meaning FBI
agents.
Yeah,
people who I work with, my buddies who I go to the water cooler with.
I'm especially sorry that there were people at the FBI who had their own chance to stop, like a chance, like it was like a carnival game.
It's a Hail Mary.
A chance to stop this monster back. Again, the FBI agent using a loaded term like monster when it was a trainer that they failed to stop. Back in 2015 and failed, and that is inexcusable. It should never have happened, and we are doing everything in our power to make sure it never happens again. Now, the guy who just said, is that it, and then sat on the report for a year, he was fired 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have things like Mr. Ray said that as a result of the Nassar case, the FBI had strengthened its policies, procedures, systems, and training, including emphasizing that its agents report. This isn't about training. This is about,
yes,
like, this is about protecting powerful people and organizations from investigations.
And two, just like the ripple effects of that, which is where who the FBI treats seriously because of the structure of that organization. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of bad faith analyses by this from the right wing. I mean, I can already see Tucker Carlson's segment on this. I don't even know if he did it last night, but this is some sort of like signal for Q. It's the deep state protecting pedophiles, right? Try to steer away from that, because what Matt said is key. This is about protecting powerful people, and that is what the FBI has done throughout its entire history. It has protected white supremacy. It has protected government officials from activists and from criticism. It has killed activists, and it has tried to maintain capital, and it has tried to, and has done so quite effectively, and it is, that's all a part of this toxic stew of protecting the powerful. And this is one of a variety of instances that you can point to historically in which they did that. And so they're not going to go out of their way to listen to a 19-year-old victim crying and giving her testimony about the sexual abuse that she faced, because that's not in the tradition of the FBI. They are not crusaders. They are not the cartoonish portrayal that, like, you know, was put out in the 1960s to say, oh, they're defending our freedom. No, they are there to protect the powerful, and that is how that institution is structured.
Yeah, I mean, Leahy had the right quote, which is, a whole lot of people should be in jail, not just one guy fired. A whole lot of people should be imprisoned for this criminal negligence. And, I mean, until something like that happens, you know, we can get as many apologies and, oh, this monster, and I'm so sorry that we missed our chances. Yeah, give me a break.
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by Dave Zirin.
Thank you to Aura for sponsoring today's episode. Aura is giving my audience 40% off when you go to aura.com/majority. That's aura.com/majority. Look, think about all your online accounts. You got finances, you got devices. What are you doing to protect them? Because if you're like most people, like me, probably reusing your password all over the place. Actually, I try not to do that, but I do that too much. And a data breach to any one of those services could create a lot of problems for you. Every 10 seconds, someone becomes a victim of fraud or identity theft, and a lot of these people never recover their stolen money. All right, so let's talk about how Aura can protect you. Aura is a new type of security service. It protects your online data. It protects your devices with one simple subscription. You get alerted to fraud, you get alerted to threats, and you get alerted fast. If your online accounts or passwords were leaked online, if someone tries to open a bank account in your name, you get alerted quick. It's got an easy online dashboard. Alerts are sent straight to your phone. Aura keeps you in control and guides you through solving any issues. All plans come with a $1 million identity theft insurance to help recover your stolen funds, and experienced U.S.-based customer support that has got your back. So if you want to secure your online presence and you want to do so from hackers and from scammers, check out Aura. You're going to get 40% off all plans when you go to Aura, aura.com/majority. The link is in the YouTube and the podcast description. Now, back to Emma.
I would like to welcome to the program, or welcome back to the program, I should say, the great Dave Zirin, sports editor at The Nation and author of many books, including the just released The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. This is right up my alley, so I'm excited to talk to Dave about this. Thanks so much for being here, Dave.
Oh, it's great to be here, Emma.
Yeah, so your book is excellent. It's essential reading if you are interested in movements, if you're interested in Black Lives Matter, and of course, if you're interested in the politics behind sports, which both of us certainly are, and you've made your career on it. And what I love about your book is that it's more than just about Kaepernick. It's quite literally about the effect. It's called The Kaepernick Effect, and it's just chronicling this extraordinary moment in history where athletes in all parts of the country, at all levels, participated in this active protest. I mean, just how monumental was this mass movement?
In 2020, in the summer after the police murder of George Floyd, we had the largest demonstrations in the history of the United States, demonstrations that hit all 50 states. And I would argue that while many roads led us to that point, one of those roads runs straight through the playing fields of this country. And the language and method of the protests on those playing fields were really bequeathed by Colin Kaepernick and what he did. See, the Kaepernick effect, it's a language, it's a method. And so what I did was I interviewed all of these athletes who were already upset about racism, who were already upset about police brutality. But if you live in Storm Lake, Iowa, or if you live in Beaumont, Texas, it's not like you can walk out your door and go to a Black Lives Matter protest. But they saw through Kaepernick how they could bring the struggle to their community. And I wanted to write about them. I wanted to write about the fallout that might have taken place. And I wanted to write about it primarily because I was really concerned that these stories were going to get forgotten, as we so often do, not just in sports, but in discussions of social movements, the people at the grassroots who kept a movement going, and not just the great heroes that we put up on pedestals.
Right. And of course, we should, I think, laud the bravery of Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid and other Kenny Stills. I think, you know, they're the most prominent NFL players who are at the forefront of this and the most vocal. Obviously, Kaepernick's a former NFL player because he was blackballed, and we can get into that a bit. But the irony of the knee being this method that outraged so much of America just goes to show that it's not the method of your protest, it's just that you're protesting at all. Because people don't realize this, but Kaepernick consulted with a former Green Beret, as we've discussed, about how to be the most respectful in his protest. Tell us a little bit about that background, because I think it just adds another layer to an understanding that this was all about just racial animus and backlash when people were talking about, oh, can't take a knee in the anthem.
Yeah, I mean, this story would almost be comedic if the results weren't so serious, and it's, if anything, darkly, darkly ironic. In August of 2016, Colin Kaepernick was sitting on the bench behind his teammates in anonymity in protest of the anthem, yet people got word of it. It caused this just absolute tumult of controversy, this tremendous backlash all over the place.
He was injured at the time, right? My recollection right?
He was coming off an injury. Because of that, he was backing up a far inferior quarterback named Blaine Gabbert, whose name is perfect for this story. It's like a Dickens story. Like, Blaine Gabbert.
It doesn't get whiter than Blaine Gabbert. And he's a journeyman. I forget. I don't even know where he's backing up now. But right, definitely inferior.
Just about guarantee he has a job somewhere because he's not Colin Kaepernick.
Yep.
So Colin Kaepernick is just sitting, and he wants to be able to be heard. He doesn't like that the debates are about the anthem and about patriotism and is this against the troops. He wants it to be about racism and police violence, issues like qualified immunity. He wants that to be on the table. So he consults with the person you referenced, a former Green Beret and NFL player named Nate Boyer. And Nate Boyer came up with this idea where he said, you know, if instead of sitting behind your teammates, which looks disrespectful, how about if you take a knee in front of your teammates as a way of showing respect for the solemnity of the situation and also registering your dissent? And that seemed like a great idea to Colin Kaepernick. It seemed like a great idea to Eric Reid, his teammate. And so they started taking a knee. Yet that just turned the volume up on everything. And it made the cacophonous voices of the hard right and Trumpism at the time, like, even all the more violent and unhinged, because they couldn't deal with the fact that that image of him being on that knee, it became instantaneously iconic. If Colin was just sitting during the anthem on a bench, that wouldn't have inspired the people that I wrote about in this book. They wouldn't have said, gee, maybe I can sit on a bench too behind my teammates. There's nothing about that that's forthright, really. But when they saw that image of the taking of the knee and all eyes gravitating towards him, that's really what inspired people, because the people I spoke with, what they wanted above all else, it was so modest, was to start a conversation in their community. And they saw by doing this they could start a conversation. Often they didn't realize the kind of whirlwind that they would be reaping, but that was their modest aim all the same.
Right. And I guess, you know, you talk about how it would be humorous if it wasn't so dark, this kind of effort by Kaepernick to make it more respectful. And I want to turn to some of the stories you tell about high school and college students in a bit. But you point out in your book the juxtaposition of Kaepernick taking a knee and Derek Chauvin taking a knee on George Floyd's neck. And that is another just poetic but darkly so kind of encapsulation of the struggle. And it has almost retroactive resonance with this deeply important moment in the murder of George Floyd.
Absolutely. And you know, and it doesn't take an American studies degree from Columbia to see that juxtaposition. The protest that I went to, you know, people were referencing that on homemade signs. People had images simultaneous with one another that they had, you know, that they had glued onto placards. I mean, this was something that was obvious to everybody who was in the movement, like just the image of the knee and the fact that Kaepernick's knee and the knee of the people that I describe in this book were completely about trying to affect change in a peaceful manner. That's what it was about. Whatever one might think of pacifism or lack or its faults, this was the goal. It was a pacifistic demonstration. And then to see that same posture be used as an instrument of murder, I mean, it was also for the folks that I spoke with, because I went back and then re-interviewed everybody after the protest started in 2020. I mean, for them, it was also like a really rough reminder of the violence that they faced when they took a knee. That far too often in this country, the response to peaceful protest is not peaceful counter debate. It's violence or the threats of violence. And so many of the people I spoke with, that was their reality. Not that any of them had regrets, far from it, but they had to face the specter that something could happen to them or their families.
So then I guess let's turn to some of these stories that you told. The opening, I think, story about a high school student named Rodney Axon Jr. really stuck with me. Tell his story for our audience.
Yeah, I mean, in brief order, Rodney Axon was from Cleveland. His parents, in an effort to get him a better education, moved to the suburbs of Brunswick at a predominantly white school, where he always felt like he had to watch his step and watch what he said, and always felt like it was a very gingerly situation. And he thought playing football would be something that would provide him with a degree of acceptance. And on one level, it did, but it also meant hearing a lot of his teammates who were white drop racial slurs left and right. And when he would raise objections to that, they would say, oh, no, but we're not talking about you. You're one of us. And that stuck in his craw something fierce. When you couple upon that the fact that over the summer of 2016, you had the same thing that influenced Colin Kaepernick, the police murders of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. It had just gotten under Rodney's skin to the point where he felt like he had to do something. And it might have just ended as an exercise in frustration and stress for him, and frankly, a degree of trauma. But seeing Colin Kaepernick take that knee, it gave him a language and a method by which he could do something. He was like, yes, he'd already even been thinking in his mind about doing something related to being on the football team because it was just out of control. And so he took that knee and he thought it would be a way to just get everybody to wake up and say like, hey, look at me. You know, I'm not quote unquote one of the good ones. You know, I object to your racism. But, you know, that did not click. Instead, he received death threats. Instead, coaches, teammates, I mean, and he braved all of this incredible backlash, but it was scary. The violent threats were what were most scary because he had a little sister.
As a high school student.
Imagine being a high school student and worrying that you might have brought harm and violence onto your elementary school age sister. And he felt like he had to walk her to school every day and she couldn't take the bus. precisely because she was his sister in Brunswick, Ohio. And I'm sure people in Brunswick, Ohio would say, oh, you know, that's not us. That's, you know, the worst of us or whatever. But, you know, like Howard Zinn said, you can't be neutral on a moving train. So if you're not standing up for Rodney Axon in a moment like this, you inevitably become part of the problem.
Yeah. And you also chronicle peaceful protests in the vein of Kaepernick kneeling in other sports, which I want to talk about as well. But there's something just so unique to the American identity and psychology that comes with the sport of football that has like hometown connections, that is both a national identity, say, you know, in Ohio, maybe as a Browns fan, but also the people in that community are fans of the high school team, and it's part of a local identity and a national one and a uniquely American one. And I think maybe that is part of this rage that is exercised. And of course, it's just all racism, but that's part of it too, which I think makes the football aspect even more punctuated.
Exactly. I mean, football, I would argue, is the closest thing to a monoculture we have in the United States. And when you look at the ratings of football games compared to other cultural products, it's ridiculous. And the Super Bowl might be the last thing that unites a national gaze, except for maybe a presidential election. I mean, this is where we are as a country, you know, very divided, very chopped up by both, you know, by the culture and our politics. And here is football, this thing that's supposed to be this instrument of community cohesion. And I would also add that because, you know, there's been so much atomization in the workplace over the last several decades, the football field becomes almost like the last public square in a community. You know, gone are the bowling leagues and the Elks clubs and things of that nature, or the Union Hall, too, for that matter, in a place like Ohio. But what you still have is this football stadium as a place to cohere your identity. And that also puts an absurd amount of stress on these 15 to 18 year olds.
And you've covered this sport. I didn't mean to cut you off, but you've covered sports for decades. Do you notice that that anxiety is heightened as the atomization's increased? As, of course, you know, parts of the country where football might be more popular, they don't have the economic opportunities that there once were, the bargaining power that unions have provided. I mean, have you made that connection throughout your reporting?
Oh, yes. I mean, high school football has always been part of the American vein, in the American vein. But high school football being a social and economic engine of a community, I mean, that's something that's much more with our 21st century time. And it's thrown everything out of whack. And it's not just high school football. I mean, we could have look at a school like Notre Dame, for example. I mean, when they start their football program a century ago, it's a textile community where there's a small Catholic college that happens to play football. Now, Notre Dame is the economy of South Bend, Indiana. And how the football program does has a ripple effect on all kinds of local businesses across the board. And there are no more textile factories in South Bend, Indiana. So we've seen a substantial change over the decades. And I've certainly even seen that in the last 20 years.
So I guess that's a good transition to talk about college football then. I was very torn by some of the images that came out in 2020 of Nick Saban, the head coach at Alabama. Most people consider him the greatest college football coach of all time. I think that's fair. Linking arms with his players in protest as he is a multimillionaire being paid in an institution that I've talked about on this show is one of the most reminiscent of slavery in its framework that we have left. These players put their blood, sweat, and tears, sometimes injure themselves for life, can't play in the pros, and get paid nothing as they rake in millions, and University of Alabama can sell their jerseys. I mean, and Nick Saban, if he wanted to speak out about that, he could. He doesn't. He links arms with his players and protests in the wake of George Floyd. And at the same time, I don't want to be too cynical, because as you highlight in your book, I wrote down this quote, which I thought was so well said. On college campuses in the 1960s, athletes were at times used to surround buildings that were occupied by student protesters in order to keep out food and supplies. Today, football players at the universities of Mississippi and Alabama are marching for racial justice. That's the positive.
That's the positive. And in a way, we can read it as a positive that a Nick Saban or a Lane Kiffin feels under so much pressure to respond to the reckoning of racism in this country that they think that they would actually lose their team if they look like an old, out-of-touch white guy, to the point of which they're willing to march in the college towns of universities, Alabama and Mississippi, with their incredibly rich tradition of poison in terms of the history of the civil rights movement, Jim Crow and segregation. So to me, it's one of those sign of the times. Is it sincere? I don't particularly think so. If it was sincere, would they be speaking about the issues that you raised? Absolutely. But it's quite a sign of the times that they even feel like they can't play their traditional role of the authoritarian Bear Bryant coach saying my way or the highway. Instead, it's them saying, wow, there is such a racial reckoning happening in this country at this moment that I better show that I'm on the train, because, you know, like we said, you can't be neutral on a moving one.
Right. And I want to talk too about ownership in the NFL, where some of these same patterns appear. But I don't want to move past college before talking about some of the stories of college players who protested. Dave, I mean, you told a variety of stories in your book, but which one stuck out to you the most?
Well, it's interesting because I talked to some football players, and they, you know, those stories and that bravery is because of the scholarships being renewed annually and the pressures that come with football on a campus. Those stories stand out. But I think of a young woman named Mink who played lacrosse at a small college in rural Illinois. And those are the stories I really like, because she stood up to her teammates. And their teammates really went after her afterwards. And it got bad enough that she eventually had to transfer schools, but still no regrets. And there's something, it says something about the potency of the moment and the potency of taking that knee, that this is, you know, women's lacrosse at a small rural college in Illinois. And she caused an absolute upheaval. Just by taking that knee, just by saying she wanted to talk about these issues. And I think when people do this, I mean, they reveal a lot of truths about a community that they otherwise would not want to see. And it takes a lot of courage to hold a mirror up to an entire community, which is what Mink did.
And how did some of these college coaches across a breadth of sports respond?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I found that the high school coaches were more likely, not always by any stretch, but were more likely to say, oh, you know, this is an educational moment. We need to talk about this as a team. We need to speak about how to support one another, than the college coaches, who tended to either openly or surreptitiously stab people in the back. Stab their players in the back. I mean, or stab them right in the front. That was really what I saw at the collegiate level. There wasn't that level of support. There was, interestingly, at the University of Nebraska, the biggest football school. I mean, the coach isn't there anymore, which says something. His name was Mike Riley, and he just happens to be a politically liberal person. So when, even though it led to an incredible backlash in the community itself, his posture was, I love this, you know, let the players protest. They have my support. Shockingly, he's not the coach there anymore. I'm not saying there's a connection, but I think it's very interesting that the coach now there is former Nebraska quarterback Scott Frost, and not, you know, West Coast California cool Mike Riley.
Yeah. Well, I said, you know, we were kind of moving more in chronological order in your book, but I want to return to the story of the Seattle high school coach who face some repercussions as well.
Joey Thomas, the coach at Garfield. Garfield is a fascinating high school in Seattle because it's the high school of Quincy Jones and Jimi Hendrix. So it's like this fulcrum of Black culture that it still is. I mean, Quincy Jones donated a whole music center to it. And yet this is a city, Seattle, that's ostensibly very liberal, that also has a very small Black population in the city itself. And so a city like Garfield, the players start taking a knee, starts with the football team, just a couple of players. And Joey Thomas's response is saying, well, I'm at Garfield. I'm in Seattle. Let's do this right. And so they had a whole team discussion about it. They spoke about the history of the national anthem, which is its own very ugly history. And they took a knee. Now, you would expect them to be applauded for this in a place like Seattle. Like, oh, look, they're young. They're so socially conscious. But these young people learned something another person I interviewed told me, which is sometimes in the eyes of adults, the only thing worse for a teenager to be than apathetic is politically active. You know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And what Joey Thomas found was his tires of his car got slashed. Death threats came into the school, death threats to individual students. More students then started to kneel, like in solidarity with the football team, whether in assemblies or, you know, the women's softball team, the women's soccer team. And I interviewed folks from these different teams to talk about how these issues connected and collided. But Joey Thomas eventually found himself out of a job. He had to quit because the level of harassment was so intense.
It's just unbelievable to me. I mean, to waste one's energy on getting that riled up about an act by a high school sports team. But I feel like we're seeing a little bit of it in this kind of masking debate where parents who project their own anxieties onto their children and talk about indoctrination and get energized to the level that's unhinged in kind of trying to bump up against what's happening in schools and what's happening with young people, which for them represents this anxiety of, oh, this, I don't understand this. This is new. And it's causing me to maybe think a little bit harder about my relationship with racism and with Black people. And so that's how it manifests, I guess.
Yeah, whether it's masking or what they deem to be critical race theory, which seems talking about slavery, is all falls under.
Or in Texas, it's just a Black principal.
A Black principal.
He's just Black.
Yeah, just the crime of being Black and having a white wife and putting picture of yourselves on Instagram.
Ah, so you knew that story too, right?
It was so repulsive that it seeped its way through my computer into my mind. But it's interesting because I was asked by another interviewer something that it was sort of in the spirit of what you just said, which is, you know, do these stories make you optimistic or pessimistic? Because I can see why one would draw pessimistic conclusions from some of these. Like, my God, you take a knee and your tires get slashed. You take a knee and you're worried for your little sister's safety on the way to school. But I came out of this book more optimistic because the people, for lack of a better term, the people I spoke with were happy warriors. You know, they'd been through so much, but they felt so good about the people they were becoming. And they saw what they did as being part of that process that it was just difficult to not be carried along on this like wave of cheer and hope for a different kind of a future.
Well, let me drag you down into pessimism when we turn to the pros, right? Because
older we get, the more pessimistic it gets in terms of the age of the people that we're talking about.
Well, exactly. And you see that like manifest itself with the children in schools who are on the right path and the parents of them slashing the coach's tires. So the parents are the ones, the older folks populating the NFL. And of course, the 32 owners are very white, very rich, and were instrumental in keeping Kaepernick blackballed and out of the league. We know that, and that's been well documented. He settled and got, we don't know the number, but a significant settlement from the NFL because his team was at least able to prove that there was some evidence of collusion, which is a very hard bar to clear, but the NFL owners were disgusting enough that they were able to do so. But I guess let's just start there with what we saw at the NFL level in the wake of Kaepernick's kind of explosive protest.
At the NFL level, you saw some players being, I would describe them as Kaepernick curious. Like a lot of players in a lot of locker rooms, and this would be from my direct reporting of talking to these players, every locker room was in a discussion about what Kaepernick was doing. And that means they were not in a discussion about, you know, whether to play a zone or man-to-man defense in the game that Sunday. So what you saw was a break from the kind of authoritarian business, you know, work harder, you know, life is tough, no one cares attitude that is the National Football League. And you saw instead players debating and discussing racism and how best to respond to it. And I think that scared the holy heck out of an NFL franchise ownership and a total executive class, too. If we want to talk about general managers, executives, almost entirely white, this is not what they wanted to see. So since then, they've adopted this carrot and stick approach to their own players. The carrot is they'll have a social justice committee that operates through acceptable parameters. The carrot is they'll put decals on the helmets, right? End racism in the end zone. The carrot is Roger Goodell will even say, as he did in 2020, why jeepers, maybe Colin Kaepernick was right to want to talk about these things 4 years ago. My gosh, golly. But the stick is Colin Kaepernick, not on a team. Eric Reed, not on a team. Kenny Stills, not on a team. And it's this message that they're sending to young players that you better stay in line or you could end up like these other guys on the outside looking in.
So I want to contrast that response with the NBA's, because you talk about how they write end racism in the end zone and like you, on the back of the helmets, they get to pick if it says Black Lives Matter or end racism, express yourself individually with these pre-picked phrases.
These corporate decals.
Yeah, exactly. And the NBA did something similar, but mm-hmm. the NBA is just better and more progressive, and they listen to their players. And I wonder, you know, what you draw that to, because one, I mean, I do think it's leadership a little bit with Adam Silver just being a better person than Roger Goodell. I think it's the nature of the sport and the culture around the sport, but also, like, I mean, is it player leadership or the culture that cultivated that kind of leadership?
Yeah, it's a ton of different factors. I mean, first and foremost, it's just the very existence of a Black Lives Matter movement. But then, you know, what it comes down to is that the best player, arguably in league history, LeBron James, decided that
Whoa.
He was going to say something. I know. Ooh, that's wow. the most controversial thing said in this interview.
One of two.
I'll throw one of three because I'm a Kareem guy, too.
I was about to say, I could see that, Dave. But yeah, anyway, keep going.
There's a lot of biases there. But
he's the man.
With LeBron, I mean, he was playing in Miami when Trayvon Martin is killed in 2012 in Sanford, Florida. So that you know, hit the team very hard, especially when Zimmerman was not getting a Trayvon's murderer. George Zimmerman was not being arrested. Remember, there was that period where they weren't even arresting him. And so, you know, this is a wild number, but, you know, over 50 high schools in South Florida staged walkouts. Another story that gets memory hold about that time. One high school, they spelled out Trayvon's name on the football field with their bodies. But the Miami Heat knew about this because it was in all the local news. We're just not remembering it historically. And so LeBron said, we have to do something about this. So they all posed with hoodies in 2012, the entire team, because hoodies being the symbol of what got Trayvon killed. And that was really the first viral sports politics photo of the Twitter age. And I think that taught a lesson to LeBron that by using social media and his own avenues, he could fulfill his dream when he was a teenager of wanting to be a political athlete like Muhammad Ali. So LeBron, in turn, bends the league towards being more, for lack of a better term, progressive and more open to what its players have to say, because he also provides this force field for any other player that wants to be political. Because how can you come down on the last player on the bench if you're not going to come down on LeBron James?
It really is quite remarkable, because he was said to be, you know, the next generational talent from age 15 on, right? And was not coddled, but I mean, had this rarefied experience that only he could understand. It's basically an audience or a group of one. And that's got to be very disorienting. And I would imagine you start kind of smelling your own farts to some degree. And so that, you know, of course that's going to affect you, but he still had the perspective to put political activism at the forefront. And I remember being frustrated that, you know, by some of his political speech, but on the whole, it really is, it's pretty impressive to keep that, you know, yeah, mooring.
The LeBron story is a fascinating one, because, and this is what makes athletes over the last 100 years, black athletes in particular, such a dangerous and volatile element in the workings of U.S. society and, you know, the daily functions of U.S. inequality, because a lot of them, like LeBron, come from extremely poor backgrounds. Michael Jordan did not come from Michael Jordan came from a stable middle-class home. And I think that's one of the reasons that affected his desire to not be political, because they were never part of the aspirations of his house, you know, collective action. But here's LeBron, you know, single mom, very poor, until, you know, people started to realize that he was going to be this talent. And then, you know, money, no question, was put in their pockets. But, you know, until he was 15, like, knowing what hunger felt like. And, you know, that's something that really never left him. And it's why he's done the educational work. It's why he's done the voting work. It's why he's spoken out against police violence. And his willingness to put it on the line, I'll say it again, it bent a league in a direction that it was not otherwise in.
And then we can return back to the NFL, right, where there has been a shift. And I remember when George Floyd was murdered and a group of players, including Mahomes, including my boy Odell, including a variety of other, you know, great superstars in the league, came out and rebuked the commissioner and basically said, this is not enough, which right, was very different than how NFL athletes are taught to be. You are a soldier. This is a militaristic operation. The Bill Belichick is judge, jury, and executioner, although apparently behind the scenes he's a lot more player friendly than he puts out publicly, but I digress. Like, it's not a fruitful environment for that kind of anti-authoritarian, we're going to use our own power, we're going to use our own platforms. And that was a huge shift in my view.
Yeah, just brief note, you know, I did that book with Michael Bennett, former NFL player, and he played briefly with the Patriots, and he really liked playing for Belichick, because he said,
they all say that, yeah,
that he leaves you the hell alone if you do your job right. And yeah, far too many coaches, they want to know what's happening in your personal life. You know, basically they're treating 28-year-old men like children. And that really rankles a lot of players, a lot. Especially,
and which players do they go after more? I can't figure that out, right?
Yeah, because there is a racial dynamic to that, yes, about having this older, usually white coach treat you like you're something of less than an adult. And so they like Belichick because, like I said, he leaves you the hell alone as long as you do your work, which is really all you can ask for. Maybe not just in football, but in life. But I'm sorry, what was the question? I got caught in Belichick land.
I guess I was just talking about the 2020 rebuke by Mahomes.
Oh, yes.
Saquon,
yes.
Barkley, Odell. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Mahomes, I mean, let's see what happens. But he's the closest thing to LeBron that you have in the National Football League. I think if Mahomes isn't in that video, and he wasn't just in the video, he was an organizer of the video. If Mahomes isn't in that video, every player in that video, including Odell, is at risk in terms of their NFL future.
Well, look at how they responded to Odell doing the black power fist in the Kaepernick era, right? I mean, distraction.
And then part of an absurdly lopsided trade that gets him off the Giants. I mean, just ridiculous. Yeah. And it was done absolutely for political reasons, not because for playing reasons.
You know, that's my team, Dave, right? So you're opening up some old wounds.
I'm sorry about that. I don't know if did you ever hear the New York Giants 1987 rap video for when they were going to the Super Bowl? You should look that up on YouTube. It'll haunt you.
Does LT spit?
He doesn't appear. Too cool.
Oh, all right.
It's all your linemen with their own hip hop stylings.
Yikes.
The 80s. So fun. But you needed Mahomes in that video. He can cast the force field. He is the one player in the NFL who is absolutely indispensable at this moment. Hopefully he'll use that power, because it, like LeBron shows, it can make a big difference.
And lastly, I just don't want to leave without talking about the dynamic that mirrored the one we saw in college football of owners like Jerry Jones, who's also the general manager, which is rare, who prides himself on having relationships and building relationships with the players on the Dallas Cowboys, still, like, for months and months, trying not to talk about the anthem. Oh, they can kneel, but not during the anthem. And only when Trump called them sons of bitches did all of the owners, they went down on and linked arms and they knelt with their players. But the protest element, what there was actually being talked about, completely washed away. All they cared about was that the president, who Jones donated money to, a lot of money, and many owners did, not John Mara, he went after, you know, their employees. That was essentially what it was, and they wanted to do something, and that really frustrated me.
Yes, and fear that they would lose their employees. The NFL so much depends upon the acceptance by players of rules that are racist, that are anti-union, even though they're in a union, that are unfair. The fact that the contracts aren't guaranteed, the fact that NFL owners held back scientific information about concussions, so there was no informed consent for what players went through for decades. There are so many reasons for that we might see a player's revolt or even a player's league, like some offshoot. And so the importance of keeping players pacified became all consuming after Colin Kaepernick started to raise a lot of people's eyebrows and saying, wait a minute, do we really need to accept things the way they are? Because Colin might have been talking about racial inequity and police violence, but once one player starts bucking the system, it raises the possibilities. The old expression, courage is contagious. It raises the possibilities and the horizons of everybody else in the league. And not just there, but in all of sports. If you want to talk about why the rules in college athletics have loosened up over the last year, or why the Washington football team felt like it had to change its name after decades of defiance and clinging to the racism of its moniker, it all dates through Colin Kaepernick taking that knee.
Yeah. And I hope for a variety of things where players in the NFL, you know, seize their power. And one of them is, you know, the CBA has already been agreed upon, but eventually contracts that aren't so exploitative, because people don't realize they only focus on the stars, the players that bear the brunt of this, the players that had the most to lose by protesting on the bubble of the roster. Their average career is very short and they don't have guaranteed contracts. And this is their time to cash in, to set them up and their families for life. And the NFL exploits them to a great degree. So, anyway, that's just something I wanted to make sure people understand.
Yeah, it's all part of the picture of understanding why we can't divorce politics from sports.
Yes.
That is absolutely baked into it. And when you hear your neighbor or your father-in-law say something like, well, I don't like politics and sports, you know, just remember that what they're saying is that they don't like a certain kind of politics with sports, because there are tons of politics in sports that they're perfectly fine with.
Dave Zirin, his book is called The Kaepernick Effect, Taking a Knee, Changing the World. I really appreciate your time today. Everyone should go out and buy it and read his stuff at The Nation, where if there's, you know, a big sports story, you'll usually have some take on it that's very much on point and well said. So
thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Emma.
We are back. I hope that everyone enjoyed that conversation with Dave Zirin. And, you know, Dave's a wonderful progressive. And, you know, just reading some of the IMs here, I think a lot of people have criticisms, and I understand they don't understand how one can enjoy a sport like that and be a progressive or have consistent values in that area. And I've always tried to advocate for the players in that instance, and I also do believe that not every moment of your life is going to be abiding by leftist principles, unless, you know, you're a vegan, hats off to you, right? But we do have to operate in these spaces as leftists, or it becomes a little insular. And sports are a huge part of our culture.
Yeah,
and
you can't give sports to capitalists. It's ridiculous.
You can't. And it's important to have these conversations in order to stymie that kind of influence, to increase player power, collective power of these players who are often black against these white billionaire owners who have been the kingmakers for so long. And that's why the Kaepernick protest was such a monumental moment, was because it was about players seizing their power, and that was a part of the pushback to it. There was capitalism involved because the players are just supposed to do their job and entertain. And Kaepernick said, "I'm not going to do that." And that pissed off a lot of people with a lot of money and a lot of racists too. So all of these things are intertwined. But that's all we have for today in terms of time for our Peacock audience. We will see you tomorrow. But for everybody else, we're sticking around.
People are saying there's a contradiction because you claim performativity is wrong, that you support Kaepernick. And I would just say there's a massive difference. And I don't think you are fundamentally against all types of performativity. It's like, what is it actually doing?
Yes.
And I'd say there's a big, big difference between Kaepernick and, I mean, let alone the yard signs, but even what happened at the Met Gala, and not to relitigate that again, because I feel like way too much time was spent on what was probably a neutral event.
Positive
right. Minus. But, like, Kaepernick literally did something on football is a propaganda vehicle for the ruling class, and to, like, I mean, we all know this stuff. Dave Zirin's talked about as good as anyone about the flyovers.
Yep.
And American propaganda. And so that type of performativity to counter a certain type of performativity by the Pentagon literally funding the NFL, I think is an entirely different class.
And people don't realize that type of performativity where the jets fly over and the national anthem is sung and everybody stands at attention, that wasn't always the case in NFL games. I believe it started during the Gulf War and was a part of a push by the Bush 1 administration, if I recall correctly. But I think the other thing I'm seeing in the chat is that CTE is a massive issue in football, and that is something that's also a contradiction. I would say that it's also, like, that's why I advocate for players' rights.
Yes, of course. The problem with CTE is, like, if players... It's a problem of hiding medical facts from laborers. If the players were in complete control and they could make the decisions themselves about how much risk they want to put their bodies into, then they would allow to do it. I mean, we don't ban MMA. I don't watch it personally. I think it's disgusting.
Yeah.
But, like, people are allowed to, and I don't know what the, let alone looking the CTE things there, but that the problem isn't that, like, it's a brutal sport. I'm sorry. The problem is the exploitation of the people who actually put on the show.
Right. And if there was adequate collective bargaining and players were able to make these risk assessments for themselves and their contracts were guaranteed, that would be a different story. So Now we are letting in Matt and Brandon. Hopefully put that a little bit to rest. I know that there was some controversy, but you know.
I also just want to say, I'm down with ownership groups.
Right.
No more owners.
Wow. We've only got one group in the NFL, the Green Bay Packers, that are owned by the fans, and that should be more frequent throughout the league.
It should be either the municipalities or the players or a combination of both.
And then you don't have, like, say, the Oakland Raiders get up and leave for Las Vegas because there's a brand new stadium there and they can make more money.
Yeah, like the capitalist involvement needs to get out of here.
That's why the whole... anyway, we could talk about this forever. Hey, guys. Hey, Matt. Hey, Brandon.
Hey, let's talk sports. Can't wait. Let's do it.
Well, we just spent the whole first hour on that, so I think we'll probably have to leave you out of this conversation. I know that's probably breaking your heart.
Very disappointing for me as well. I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, yeah. I knew that I'd be dealing you guys a blow, but hopefully I can make it up to you by allowing you to promote your podcasts on the show. So gracefully, I might add.
And seamlessly transitioning into that as well.
Mm-hmm. I know. I'm a professional.
Very good. I guess I'll go first. Let's do it. All right. So, folks, I was just recently, just this week, demonetized on YouTube. I'm being censored.
Whoa.
Ladies and gentlemen, my free speech rights are being curtailed, so I need your help and support by subscribing to my YouTube channel, I guess, youtube.com/Matt Binder. No live show tonight because today is my significant other's birthday.
Oh.
To make up for that, though, I did a live show last night, which you can catch on the replay. And it's on youtube.com/Matt Binder right now. Go check it out.
And Brandon, what's happening over on the discourse?
We actually are just about to post our 9/11 20th anniversary memorial episode where we talk about, you know, the pre 9/11 landscape, the post 9/11 landscape, and sort of like that 20 year time and how it changed America, pop culture, you know, social structure, et cetera, et cetera. You know, from a more personal lens of me and my co-host, or my co-host and I, rather, all have being of different age and being sort of like at different stages of our life when that was going on. So I think it's a pretty interesting episode.
Yeah, it sounds it. It sounds serious.
I don't want to oversell it because, you know, it kind of starts off with a really inappropriate joke. So,
okay, well then as is the way.
And then that tone kind of continues throughout the entire thing. So I just want people to be prepared.
Okay, so not serious at all. Got it.
It depends on how serious you take the topic matter.
Well, that's a good point. Matt, what's happening over on Left Reckoning?
Last night on Left Reckoning, we had Darna Noor on to talk about Entergy, the climate-denying public utility that is currently failing New Orleans, including how they planned with a third-party group called the Hawthorne Group to stack public meetings with actors. And there's emails saying, we don't normally recommend this because people wonder, like, hey, where did all these people I don't recognize come from? But it'll be $6,500 for 10 people. And the Entergy CEO said, this is war. We need all hands on deck. And we'll take more people if you can get them. So we talked about that. We also talked about Bitcoin. And ghoulish way. Yeah, Binder, you'd like this. The ghoulish way that Bitcoin boosters like to travel around the world and find tragedy and suggest Bitcoin as a remedy for that tragedy. For instance, in Palestine or Afghanistan or wherever there's people dying or being oppressed. And we talked about that. And also in El Salvador, we recently heard a lot about how Bitcoin's going to solve the remittance issue for a country that really relies on remittances. And in fact, it hasn't turned out that way. And it's a big disaster.
Quite the opposite, along with the disaster that's going on where people are literally protesting in the streets. And one of the biggest Bitcoin critics in that country was arrested on shaky reasons. Mm. The remittance actually is not true. In fact, now that it's rolled out there, remittance fees are less when not dealing with Bitcoin, because obviously Bitcoin fees exist, too.
Right. And it turns out that, like, Binder, I'm sure you agree with this, that the only reason they were talking about remittances is because it was a nice way to sell a product that they want the value to inflate so they can sell higher.
I saw this being circulated the other day. BitcoinMagazine.com had an article that says, can Bitcoin bring Palestine freedom?
Yeah, exactly.
They have a lot of those. And a lot of those articles are written by someone who is an executive at that quote unquote Human Rights Foundation, which is one of the organizations that were very much a part of the coup, supporting the coup that threw Evo Morales out of office in Bolivia. They had hired the young woman who I had a debate with on my show, who was a strong critic in that country of Morales. And she claimed that she was not supportive of Jeanine. Oh my God, what's her name? What was her name? Jeanine Inez. And then after she swore up and down she had no allegiance to her, a few days later after I spoke with her, she appears on her Instagram with a photo of the two of them together saying how proud she is to stand with the first Bolivian woman president.
That's very interesting. Yeah, because we can talk about that's Alexis Gladstein who writes those articles. And he writes decolonial stuff like that. And I was sickened to find that Human Rights Foundation connection too, because you know, notice he's not talking about Bukele, right?
Mm. No, absolutely not.
Yeah, and you would think somebody with a human rights portfolio would be have an eye on that, but he's more concerned with boosting a boosting cryptocurrency, and that is something that deserves more scrutiny going forward.
You know, and you hear Bitcoin Magazine, and you assume, okay, this is a, you know, obviously they cover crypto, and they probably have like a, you know, a more positive view than the rest of people, but it's still a news outlet, right? I just want to be clear, Bitcoin Magazine is straight up like a propaganda arm for Bitcoin. It is fully like a outlet that only talks positively about Bitcoin and pushes it and promotes it. I mean, there are cryptocurrency like news sites that obviously look at it in a, you know, in a manner that's more positive than you or I, but they do critique where it fails. That's not the case with Bitcoin Magazine. So I wouldn't trust anything that comes out of that that outlet, if you can even call it that.
All right, the leftist infighting continues. Bitcoin Magazine versus the Majority Report.
Well, they're not leftists, so don't
I'm joking. I'm being sarcastic. 646-257-3920. See you in the... Oh, check out Nomi's show, AM Quickie, all that good stuff. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
I see white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
Lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Black. Alpha males are black. Black. Africans are back. Back.
Come on.
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.